Kanawai Trail 3.
After our attack on the Japanese at White City, we were down to rather less than half strength from various other incidents small battles, and it was decided that 16 Brigade would move to the stronghold known as Broadway and be flown out. You must remember that 16 Brigade had been in Burma a month longer than the other brigades and had walked in rather than fly in by Dakota or by glider. So at the end of May, we flew out from Broadway, landed at Camilla in Assam, where we're all hospitalized for 10 days to get rid of the malaria that was supposed to be in each one of us, although we had suppressed it by one mepocrine tablet every day.
Was the flight out from Broadway, did it go smoothly?
The flight out from Broadway went over very smoothly indeed. No incident whatsoever. And from Camilla, we were evacuated to India and started almost immediately preparing for a further Chindit operation in 1945. The third Chindit operation did not happen because after the Japanese withdrew from Kohima and Imphal, the British moved through Burma so fast that there was no requirement for a third Chindit operation behind the Japanese lines. And we became a parachute battalion and did our training at Cheklala base near Rawalpindi, now in Pakistan. From there, we moved to Bilaspur, about 100 miles from Calcutta, to prepare for Operation Zipper, a landing on the Malayan coast. But after the first atomic bomb was dropped, we suddenly got a message one night that we had to produce three company commanders to go to Calcutta and lead teams of four into various places such as Java, Sumatra, Malaya, Siam, where there were prisoner of war camps.
Can I interrupt you there before we go on to the prisoner of war period to ask you some more questions about the Chindits, please?
Certainly.
To clarify a few things. Now, what rank did you have whilst you were a Chindit in the second Chindit operation?
I was a major.
And you were second in command of 5-4 column?
That's right, yes.
Which was part of 16 Brigade?
Which was part of 4-5 Recce. 4-5 Recce was split into two columns, one numbered 4-5 and the other 5-4.
But you marched in with 16 Brigade?
Marched in with 16 Brigade. In 16 Brigade, there were 4-5 Recce, 2nd Leicester's, 2nd Queen's, and that was it.
Did you have close contact with Mike Calvert, apart from that time you saw him on the grey horse?
No further contact inside Burma, no. I did see him later on, when we were initially training for the 3rd Chindit operation.
And you said that your training period for the Chindit operation took part in the last few months of 1943.
Correct.
What did you think of the quality of that training as far as preparing you for what was to come was concerned?
Absolutely first class. It trained us in all the techniques we required in Burma. And in fact, at the end of it, everyone regarded the jungle as our friend and open spaces as our enemy. We were completely familiar with what to do and what life was like in the jungle.
But presumably it wasn't the same type of jungle that you had in Burma that you trained in.
It was much thinner jungle than Burma. And therefore, on our training, we were able to move 15, 20 miles a day because it was only part of the time did we have to have the slashers out in front cutting their way through the jungle. In Burma, there were days when we only moved 2 miles in 10 hours when we were going over a mountain ridge because there were places where we had to cut steps for the mules to clamber up, and we had to manhandle the mule loads over these knife ridges. So being on your feet with this load for 10 hours and only do 1 mile is far more wearying than doing 10 or 20 miles.
Which part of India was the training done in?
In central India, between Jhansi and Sorgha. I remember once after an exercise crossing the river between Jhansi and Sorgha, and my CO, who was a great swimmer, said to me, we'll have a swim. And from this ferry, which was taking across, we plunged into the river, and then one of the natives on the boat shouted, "Mugga!" And I knew enough Urdu to realise there were crocodiles coming after us. And it is the most peculiar feeling trying to swim faster than you can, and you hardly seem to move. But fortunately, they got their rifles out, though I could feel this crocodile almost at my feet. The rifles cracked out and we were safe. I don't think I'd like to have my feet pulled under with a crocodile.
What was your attitude towards the mules that you took in? Did you develop an affection for them?
Great affection. And although we were quite literally starving at times after we had not been able to get our supply drops. Sometimes there were areas where the jungle was just too thick, impossible to get a supply drop. And it was considered a mule must be killed. But such was the feeling, it was decided we would go on and go on rather than kill a mule. We loved them.
Did you get to know them individually?
Well, each one had his muleteer, and the muleteer slept with his mate by his mule. And you did get to know the mules that were looking after the rifle company, the mules that were looking after the heavy weapons company, and so on. Yes, I knew all the mules that were with my rifle company.
Did they differ in personality?
Not a lot. They all kick with their hind feet if you did the wrong things behind them and were too near. And I, in my training, I broke one of my fingers. You can still see that.
I
had a little plaster of Paris on my finger from a mule kick.
But were you meant to eat the mules?
It was never said. It was always an unspoken thing that they were a source of food if needed.
Why did you assume that you would be tortured by the Japanese if you were captured?
It is because we passed within 30 yards of 10 Japanese who were all wounded, and the Japanese round them were jabbering with anger, I just felt certain we would be, that they wouldn't just be very Christian and shoot us just like that.
You mentioned the Yuyu River. How do you spell that?
U-Y-U. I will show you it on the map later on. Because I've got my silk... It was a misnomer to call a silk panic map. But it meant if you were cut off and on your own, you had a map that covered the whole of Burma and could probably make your way roughly in the direction where you wanted to go.
Some people seem to assume that the Chindits were an elite. Do you think that that's a correct characterization?
I don't think it is a correct characterization. My experience during the army life, during the war and after war, is that if you take any 100 Britishers, cross-section, any 100 Britishers, and they have the right training, they will be the same as the next 100. For instance, I vividly remember one battalion, and I've mentioned no names, where B Company was known as the useless company. No good whatsoever. And I remember the CO sending a certain major to that company and transferring the company commander somewhere else. Within 1 month, that company, B Company, started winning everything in the battalion and were regarded as the best of the battalion. It is the leadership that brings out what is there, and that is why I say in every 100 men they will all be the same or as good as each other if they've got the leadership.
What is required in the leadership?
Now, let me give you an example. This company was highly indisciplined because it had a company commander who believed by exhortation, everything like that, even the best men could be made a good again. It doesn't work out that way. And in this place, in this barracks, on Christmas Eve, a few days after this company commander had taken over, this undisciplined company, on Christmas night, threw their steel wardrobes from the fourth story of their barrack room onto the square below. The next day, the company commander drew them up and told them how he realized how fond they were of their wardrobes. And so they could go back in their barracks, get them out, and have each section carry a wardrobe from one end of the playground to another, and they'd have wardrobe races because they loved their wardrobes so much. That never happened again, and that was the start of the discipline coming right. And I remember those men later on saying, well, we had this funny do-gooder looking after us. Why shouldn't we do what we wanted? And it was that type of leadership. And 2 weeks later, when they went on exercise, this company commander happened to take a javelin, long jump material, and batons out. And during this 10-day exercise, he practiced athletics. A month later, at the athletic meeting, that company was champion company. And it was almost a miracle. This one man changed that company round. The change started to appear, obviously, within 1 month. Britishers, they're great stuff. But the bad hats are bad hats anywhere, and there are always one or two. My gosh, even in peacetime, as a guide pre-war to earn a bit of money in the summer holidays, taking 40 people around France from Paris to Nice, and staying a night at Lyon on the way down and at Aix-les-Bains on the way back, I never had a trip where was a perfect trip. There were always one or two bad hats, and I never knew whether they're going to be men or women.
What constituted a bad hat?
Always late getting up. Always managing to get drunk at the midday meal. Always making a nuisance of themselves immediately after and wanting the bus to stop. In fact, thoroughly irritating all the rest of the tourists.
So the company commander you mentioned was somebody who you said he just exhorted and was a do-gooder, so he didn't impose any discipline, you mean?
Didn't impose any discipline. His idea was, if you could only talk to these people, they will respect you and they will understand. You can't. Some brains, unfortunately, aren't capable of it. They haven't been developed. Some people suffer from underdeveloped brains. And they do not understand softness at all. Neither do the Arabs.
We'll come on to that later. Now, can we pick up the story with you, where I interrupted you, with your having been given this job, or you were just about to say that you were going to be given this job, dealing with the POWs of the Japanese?
Yes. I was picked out with a team and sent with two other teams from my battalion to Calcutta to join and be briefed by part of the SOE, and this particular part was called Force 136, RAPWI, Rescue of Allied Prisoners of War. We were briefed the first 24 hours we were there, and we were flown in the Bombay of a Liberator, my team, to an area on the Mekong River near a town called Ubon. And there was a prisoner of war camp some 10 miles to the north with 1,500 Dutch, 1,500 British, and 100 Australians. We dropped by night, and the appreciation was that after the first atomic bomb had dropped, things would go around like wildfire right through the Far East, but it was not known whether the Japanese would react by killing the prisoner of war because of the shame that was descending on their country, or whether they'd give themselves up. When we dropped, and it was in darkness, I made my way to the camp with the four, and I decided that rather than creeping up stealthily, that might frighten the Japanese into reacting. I decided, as I broke from the jungle, some 200 yards away from the compound, that I would openly get up, that I would let them see me throw my rifle to the ground, and then walk with one other towards the camp main gate. And the appreciation worked out because the Japanese came out and they gave up, laid down all their arms, ammunition, and they say, "We now take you to the British camp commandant, and he is the boss here." Spent 10 days in that camp, been visited one day by Lady Mountbatten, who had a splendid prisoners of war lunch of peanut soup, peanut stew and peanut bread. And she professed it to be delicious. She was very good. Great morale raiser. And while we were there, we spent 10 days arranging for clothes to be dropped in, arranging for them to have a little trip into the town to look at the local cinema, which was a screen drawn up between two primitive streets, and you watched it projected onto the screen in the open air.
Who was the camp commandant there? Who was the senior British officer?
The camp commandant was a man called Lieutenant Colonel Toosey, T-W-O-S-E-Y, who later was a director of Lever Brothers and had a very senior position in industry. He had been marvellous. The discipline in the camp was terrific, absolutely terrific.
What was the condition of the PRWs?
The conditions were, I think, there probably out of 3,000, there were about 100 who looked as if they'd just come back from holiday. They looked so fit, brown and tanned.
Were they emaciated?
They were thin, but some of them had managed to get extra rations while they were prisoners of war by using their brains. For instance, they knew that the one great fear of the Japanese was cholera. And cholera is a fly-borne disease. And so any prisoner of war who handed in 100 flies was given a double ration that day. Now, one group of them had a little fly factory which consisted of a glass jar, and they saved the odd bit of meat from their midday stew. They had it underground below their sleeping basha, and they bred flies in this jar. And so nearly every 3 days, they didn't want to overdo it, they produced the flies and had a double ration, which was ingenuity.
And the camp was at Ubon?
Ubon, U-B-O-N. Surprisingly enough, Ubon contains 100,000 people. And this camp was about 10 miles to the north and about 20 miles to the west of the Mekong River, which is a mile wide.
You said that 100 of them looked well, but what about the others?
The others were from a position where a few were dying each day, even while we were there, through dreadful sores on their arms and legs and everywhere, through to reasonably fit people, and remember, the sun had tanned them, but I'd say at least 80% of them had these dreadful sores on their arms and legs and chest. Now, they were, while we were there, I was told to, I've got to choose my words carefully, to see if I could get them slightly used to civilization before they were flown back. And so I met the local police in this town, and I had an officer's place in the police headquarters where a few girls were there to sing and dance to the officers while they were there, and ditto a few halls throughout the town where local girls were there to sing and dance and entertain the troops. And the troops were taken in these old Japanese lorries, which were run on sort of kerosene made from, artificial kerosene. But I think the transition from being flown as it would be from Bangkok to Calcutta and then to London or Australia the authorities said would be too much. They were to be given a little entertainment and get used to civilization, although it was Siamese civilization. The entertainment was very good and well laid on, and the police had everything medically inspected.
What did you think of the Japanese who were running the camp? Did you feel they were culpable?
The Japanese were running the camp. This is where I learnt my lesson. When the prisoners of war, many of them told me they were nearly as cruel to their own people who were sick as they were to them. And this prisoner of war camp must have been unusual, and they said that their commandant, camp commandant, Colonel Toosey, seemed to know exactly how far to go without getting into a physical dialogue with them.
Who were the other three who were in your team?
One was a Captain Lang, who was RAMC, a Scot, and I can't remember the names of the other two. One was a signal sergeant and one was an admin sergeant. And they were there to do all the signalling that was required, and the admin sergeant was going to help me, together with someone called David Smiley, who was also operating in the area, on incursions into French Indochina, which we did at a place called Pakse, P-A-K-S-E, and another place called Thakek, T-H-A-K-K-E-K, and in the middle, a place called Savannaket, which is S-A-V-A-N-N-A-K-H-E-T, which I so well remember, because there the mission was to take some ammunition and Bren guns to the village and persuade them to take us across the Mekong River, where it was known that a lot of the French internees had broken out of prison and were at large in the jungle. I sat down with the headman of the village and two or three of his henchmen, and I explained exactly what I wanted, because I had one of the Siamese could speak English and interpreted what I said. I wanted the country boats, two of them, to take several thousand rounds of ammunition and several machine guns across the river, where I said we will meet, and I explained what these French people had gone through during the war, and we will give them some arms and ammunition. And he put his hands up in horror and kept shouting Japanloo, Japanloo, and pointing. He said they're all along the river there. So I went on talking and letting my mind